This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Kenya's opposition leader called on people to stay home Monday to protest the results of last week's election. Some have heeded the call, but many others returned to work despite uncertainty about what the opposition will do next.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, an early morning mudslide may have killed more than 300 people in Sierra Leone. The treason trial of Zambia's jailed opposition leader is about to begin. And due to escalating violence, prolonged conflict and displacement, hunger is on the rise in CAR and Eastern DRC.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the death toll is expected to rise in Sierra Leone, where an early morning mudslide may have killed more than 300 people. The tragedy follows heavy rains. Reuters reports police and military personnel are conducting search and rescue operations in the Juba and region areas of the capital, Freetown. Vice President Victor Foe says it is likely hundreds are lying dead underneath the rubble. The mudslide struck while many people were sleeping. About 2,000 people have been left homeless in Regent.
Kenya's opposition leader called on people to stay home today to protest the results of last week's election. Some heeded the call, but many others returned to work despite uncertainty about what the opposition would do next. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
After a week of mostly empty streets, Kenya's capital city is coming back to normal. Traffic is flowing and people are going back to work. That does not mean the dispute over the August 8th presidential election is over. The opposition says the election was rigged and has refused to concede defeat after incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta was declared the winner with 54% of the vote. The announcement of the presidential results was followed by a protest in some parts of Nairobi and western regions that are strongholds of Kenyatta's main challenger, opposition leader Raila Odinga. Slum areas in Nairobi, like Mathare, have witnessed much of the violence. Some youth gather in groups to discuss the election and the future of the opposition. Odinga visited the neighbourhood on Sunday and called on his supporters to stay away from work in protest. 35-year-old John Mark has refused to open his welding business. I want to know what he will tell us tomorrow. If Raila tells me to open my business, I will do so. But also, I would like him to tell me where my vote is and what he intends to do. Unlike Mark, Stephen Odhiambo has opened his food kiosk in Mathare. He says business has not been good since Uhuru was announced the winner, and his customers are afraid to come. He adds there are those who come in, but will run again because of continuing battles between the police and demonstrators. And if they get out, they are beaten by police. The opposition says more than 100 protesters have been killed by the police across the country since the election. The security agencies have denied the accusations, and the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights said 24 people have been killed. President-elect Kenyatta said the election is over and the majority of Kenyans have returned to work. He called for his opponents to accept the outcome and for the aggrieved to pursue their cases in legal ways. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mohamed. Well, for an analysis of Kenya's election, reporter Ruben Chama spoke to Macharia Munene, political analyst and professor of history and international relations at the United States International University. Professor Munene first spoke about the accuracy of the vote count.
This election was as accurate as it can be, mainly because of the safeguards that were there. There was no way of hacking into the system. Taking it from the IBC, from the safeguards in that system could not be hacked by anyone. The results, as announced at the polling station, are very accurate, and that's what was reflected in Bomas. There was this erroneous belief that the votes get changed in Nairobi. So to stop that from happening, you announce the votes as they were cast at the polling station. And the announcement is not secret. It's a public engagement. And you even pin the results at the door there for anyone to see. At this polling station, these are the results. Those results were then transmitted electronically to the constituency headquarters and to the county headquarters and to Nairobi. So there was that multiple record of what happened in a particular station. Each of the agents was given a copy of the results which they had signed. So there is no claim that it was from the base there. Now, the only thing that could be raised is whether the results received electronically were any different from the ones transmitted from the polling station. Should that unlikely thing happen, it will be the hard copy that will be counted, not the electronic version. And then the presiding officer will have some answers to give, because the question will be, is this what you transmitted, yes or no?
Professor, the former U.S. Secretary of State Kerry and the former President Barack Obama have called for calm. Is their call likely to have much influence, especially on the protesters?
Well, the influence they have is among the reasonable people. If somebody had some doubts, John Kerry had already made his pledge, and it was dismissed. So the question is, would Obama's call have some influence? Would they listen? Because now the call, let's stop beating about the bush. The call is on Raila Odinga to behave. You lost the election fair and square. Rein in your forces, whatever they may be called, and say, look, we don't like it. We lost. If you can do that, he may look to be greater than he is.
That's Macharia Munene, political analyst and professor of history and international relations at the United States International University. He spoke with reporter Ruben Chama in Nairobi.
Zambia's jailed opposition leader begins his treason trial later this week after pleading not guilty today. That's despite rumors that prosecutors plan to drop charges. Last week, the president and opposition agreed to an internationally mediated dialogue to resolve months of political impasse. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Hakainde Hichilema's lawyer was tight-lipped about the case he plans to present when the opposition leader appears in court later this week on treason charges. Keith Wemba spoke to VOA from Lusaka, the capital.
They have pleaded not guilty to the charge, and then the matter has been adjourned for trial to Wednesday.
Hichilema was arrested after an April incident in which his convoy refused to yield to the president's motorcade on a narrow country road. The political impasse started when Hichilema cried foul after losing last year's election to President Edgar Lungu, and has intensified since the opposition leader was arrested. The case has deepened the nation's political crisis and prompted international mediators to intervene. Journalists were barred from the courtroom Monday. The day before, several media outlets had reported Hichilema's charges were to be dropped and he was to be released. But it did not happen. Analyst Nicole Beardsworth says it is not known why prosecutors did not enter a nolle prosequi, a legal move that means unwilling to pursue.
Speculation is that the reason for this is that because of all the media coverage of the intention to enter a nolle, that actually the UPND was going to use it as a sort of photo opportunity, that some prominent politicians from around the region were in the courtroom, and so the government or the prosecutor decided not to enter the nolle today.
Neither the nation's justice minister, information minister, nor ruling party spokesman answered numerous calls seeking comment. But no one believes the end of this trial will bring the political crisis to an end. Last week, the Secretary General of the Commonwealth Group of Former British Colonies led a delegation to launch talks between Hichilema and Lungu. Analyst Ryan Cummings says the talks will be lengthy.
I think it's going to be quite a consultative process, first and foremost, and definitely something that will continuously play out over the coming months, weeks, months, and possibly years as we move into the next election.
Zambia, he notes, has also suffered from a double whammy of a harsh drought and slumping prices of its main export, copper. He says the talks also need to discuss how to rescue the ailing economy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
UN humanitarian agencies warn that hunger is on the rise in central and eastern DRC due to escalating violence, prolonged conflict, and displacement. They estimate 7.7 million people now face acute hunger, a 30% increase over last year. The World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization say the crises in the Kasai and Tanganyika regions are made worse by an invasion of fall army worms, along with outbreaks of cholera and measles. Nearly 2 million people have been displaced over the past year in the two regions, mostly in Kasai. That brings the total number of displaced in the DRC to 3.7 million. Alexis Bonte is the interim FAO representative in Kinshasa. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCampoa.
The main reason of the displacement is the conflict. So in the Kasai, you have a conflict between the population and some representation of entities from the local authorities. And in the Tanganyika, it's mainly between two communities, the Twa, let's say the Pygmies, and the Bantu. And the reason why it goes to that level of food insecurity. The first reason is because they are farmers, and when they are displaced, they cannot grow and they cannot harvest. And secondly, because they are extremely poor. The level of poverty in the country, it's more or less 63% at national level. But when you go to Kasai only, it's around 75%. So when these people have to displace, they have no savings, they have nothing to cope.
Can you give us an idea of how these people are coping with this acute hunger? How are they trying to survive?
The only thing they can do if they don't receive any assistance is begging to the communities they are meeting or to sell their manpower, so like agriculture, labor. And of course, they don't get money for that, but they will get some food assistance from the local community. But what we are doing as a humanitarian organization and as FAO, for example, in Chicapa, where we have more than 50,000 displaced, we organize with local NGOs for them to find the land around the river Kasai, and then we send two trucks from Kinshasa full of seeds, hoes, hand tools, etc., to make sure that they can cultivate. I think now we are almost like 20 to 30 hectares of vegetable production, and it's mainly for the women.
Would you give me a little more information about the city of Chicapa that you talk about?
Chicapa is the capital city of Kasai province. It's like 100 kilometers from the Angola province. When I was in Chicapa last month, we met with the displaced person, the ladies, and the story is, unfortunately, is almost always the same. So they were in the field, then when they went back to their village, they have been informed that their husband has been killed, two or three children have been missing, and then they fled with only one or two kids. And they walk from almost the border from Angola to Chicapa, which is more or less like 80 to 100 kilometers. And they've been walking like this for like 3 to 4, 5 days, trying just to escape. And we have seen even children with wounds by machetes and gunshots. They've been in Chicapa for like 2 months. And finally, they can produce part of their own food, but also they can start to sell what they are producing. So that's the material part.
How badly have they been affected psychologically, do you know?
The important part that we notice is the social part. Just after the conflict, they were not talking. They were like traumatized. Now that they are back working in agriculture, these fields, it's like a social platform. And they are talking to each other. They are working together. The last time I went there, they were dancing and singing. Can you imagine to dance and sing after what happened to your family when the husband has been killed, the children has disappeared? And that just the fact that they are together and working together, it allows them to forget a bit the trauma that they have lived.
How difficult is it for the FAO and the WFP to actually reach those in need? Or do the people in need have to travel to where you are?
There are two main challenges. The first one, the access for security reasons, and in some areas for physical reasons because the roads are so bad. Another important reason is we are lacking some funds to act. So we cannot go too many times to see the people. So now with WFP, we have been doing a lot of advocacy to the donors, and we are now just like expecting to receive some financial support from them. So now it's only like two or three donors that had the capacity to react very quickly. But the funds that are required, I think it was like $60 million, and we have received between 10 to 15 up to now.
Alexis Bonte is the interim FAO representative in the DRC capital, Kinshasa. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. An early morning mudslide may have killed more than 300 people in Sierra Leone. Kenya's opposition leader called on people to stay home today to protest the results of last week's election. And the treason trial of Zambia's jailed opposition leader is about to begin. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Three humanitarian aid groups are suspending migrant rescues in the Mediterranean. They say they feel threatened by the Libyan Coast Guard and that their crews can no longer work safely at sea. The Libyan Coast Guard told an Italian newspaper that the NGOs did not respect their laws and offered a great service to traffickers. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the story and provides details for us.
Yes, this is significant. Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, and Germany's CI NGO have said that their crews will no longer be able to work safely in the Mediterranean because of what they consider to be a hostile approach from the Libyan authorities. They all feel that by withdrawing, they are leaving migrants at great risk. MSF, Doctors Without Borders, issued a statement on Saturday saying, if there are fewer boats to save people from drowning, those who do not drown will be taken back to Libya by the Libyan Coast Guard. And the organization sees Libya as a place of complete lawlessness, arbitrary detention and extreme violence. Amnesty International, the human rights group, has also warned the European and the Libyan authorities to stop stigmatizing, what they call stigmatizing and attacking NGOs. Saving lives is not a crime, is what they say. So we've seen this very strong stance from the Libyan authorities in recent days, concerned also about the arrival of Italian naval vessels in the area. But the Italians have also been concerned about NGOs operating without scrutiny, without controls, allegations that they are communicating directly with people smugglers. And there's been great tension on all sides here. And it'll be interesting to see what happens now, because these NGOs have been committed to saving lives in the Mediterranean in recent years.
So at this point, then, what is Italy's government going to do?
Tension has been growing for weeks now between the aid organizations and the Italian government. With this decision to withdraw, there are very few vessels now in the Mediterranean. MSF, Doctors Without Borders, has one vessel there. Proactive Open Arms, another organization, has two ships in Malta. But these operations don't look like they're going to go ahead. The Italian government is saying that they will call on the European Union to provide ships and also call on merchant vessels to intervene if there is an emergency and lives need to be saved. The NGOs really don't feel that that is going to be a solution, and they're very concerned that migrants' lives may be threatened by these decisions.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with us from Rome.
Zimbabwe is celebrating Heroes Day today. It's dedicated to those who fought against white minority rule and for independence over 30 years ago. Reporter Kudzai Zanashi asks some Zimbabweans what the day means to them.
Heroes Day evokes different images to different generations of Zimbabweans. Mukudzei Majoni, a young Zimbabwean, explains what a national hero means to him.
I think a hero is someone who is selfless, someone who dedicates their life to the upliftment of his fellow citizens and community.
Alexander Rosero is an academic and political analyst. He says the Heroes Day has lost its meaning.
The upcoming Heroes Day, which is supposed to be a day where Zimbabweans celebrate, cherish the freedom that was brought about by the liberation struggle in 1980 has unfortunately lost its meaning. The Heroes' Day is all but gone, given the social ills that are ravaging Zimbabwe, given the total cluelessness in as much as arresting the economic decline by the government of the day is concerned.
Rosero says the benefits of the populist liberation struggle have benefited a small number of people.
Ironically, you have a liberation party movement leading a government, but the dividends of liberation have not trickled down to the people. So it's a scenario of a few elites enjoying the fruits of liberation.
A few kilometers west of Harare Central Business District lies the Heroes Acre, dedicated to some of the people who played major roles in the liberation struggle. Privilege Muswaniri is a journalist who has been following politics for years. He says some heroes from the liberation war are not recognized.
Over the years, if you look at what then define a hero, it's kind of hazy and it's becoming problematic in terms of if you look at how a hero is defined. We know of some people who we viewed as heroes who fought the liberation struggle, but they are not there at the national shrine simply because maybe they crossed paths with those in leadership today. The trend that you notice is that once you cross paths, your hero status is taken away from you.
Muswaniri gives an example of Kenan Banana, who was the first president of independent Zimbabwe, but is buried in his rural home in Matabeleland. The majority war veterans who disowned President Mugabe as their patron and left the ruling party are likely not to receive hero status when they pass on. Critics say the Heroes' Day should not be about a war that was fought 37 years ago, but it should also recognize heroes from younger generations as well. Some say this would include activists who speak out against injustice and budding entrepreneurs who are creating startups even during economic decline. Until such calls are addressed, national heroes must meet two strict criteria: participation in the liberation struggle and loyalty to the ruling party ZANU-PF. For VOA, this is Kudzai Nawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, troubling times in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The United States says it's concerned at the inability of both the DRC government and an opposition coalition to implement a political transition agreement reached last December. A DRC political discussion.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Van Dyke, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.